The first time I met her, I was 19, and I was playing my music too loud. I just moved into an apartment in West Hollywood, one of those small courtyard apartment buildings that had been all the rage in the 1920s. The building was tired by the time I moved in, housing a collection of characters, and I include myself in that collection, who didn't exactly belong together. I'd seen this older woman a couple of times before, walking slowly back from the market, scarf tied around her head. My friends called her that Russian lady who never smiles, though we had no idea if she were actually Russian. Anyway, one day I was cleaning my apartment and my music was on. Not too loud, I thought, but then the little complex was small and sounds tended to echo through the courtyard. Someone rapped on my door. I answered the knock. There she stood, stone-faced. Those sounds, too much. Sorry, I didn't realize. It won't happen again. I'm Jason, by the way. I stuck out my hand. She didn't take it, but she did nod and say, Olga, before stalking off. Now, I figured this was the last direct contact I'd have with her, and sure enough, over the next few weeks, when she passed my door, headed to the market, I would optimistically wave, but she never waved back, though occasionally she'd give me a quick nod. One day, I heard a knock at my door and went to answer it, and there stood Olga. She had a plate in her hands. I make, she said, thrusting the plate into my hands and then disappearing. They were some kind of potato dumplings, and they were good. A couple of days later, I knocked on her door to return the plate and thank her. Come in, said Olga when she answered the door, bringing me into her little apartment, a mirror for my own in layout, but so different with the little painted wooden dolls sitting on the tables and the elaborately decorated porcelain sitting on a high shelf. Have coffee, Olga said. Then I knew I was meant to sit and drink the thick, dark liquid she made. I did. And as we sat, Olga began to speak. Her English was far more extensive than I had thought, and the words began to pour out of her very deliberately, matter-of-factly. She spoke of Bosnia, the soldiers that had come in the night, the prison camp, and the family she would never see again. She spoke of the way her leg had been stepped on and broken and never healed properly. She spoke of going back to the village where her home had been, but the whole village was gone. I was 19. I didn't know what to say. How, I finally asked, how did you carry on? She looked at me for a long time, and then took a sip of that strong coffee. It's good coffee, she said. It's good coffee. And that was my answer. I've always remembered that. It's good coffee. It wasn't just a declarative statement. It was the answer to my question of how you find hope after something has been so horrible. Back in 1959, Beacon Press, the Unitarian Universalist publishing house, released Viktor Frankl's autobiographical book, Man's Search for Meaning, a book that also answered this question I posed to Olga by detailing Frankl's experiences in a German concentration camp during World War II, and Juana read one of those anecdotes from that. In 1930, Viktor Frankl graduated from the University of Vienna Medical School, began working in the university's neurology and psychiatric clinic. In December 1941, he and Tilly Grosser were among the last Jewish couples the Nazis allowed to wed. In the very next month, they arrested Frankl's family and separated them into different camps. Now, as we know, life in those camps was agonizingly horrible. Frankl writes that in time, prisoners move from a state of shock to one of apathy. As Roger Fritz writes, The prisoners learned that if they did not express any emotion, if they appeared apathetic about suffering and dying, they were more likely to survive. Over time, many prisoners moved from this apathy to depression. That depression was so deep that the sufferers could not move or wash or leave the barracks to join a forced march. No pleas, no blows, no threats had any effect. These men had lost all hope in the future. Frankl writes how he and others would remind the most depressed prisoners that life still expected something from them, whether it was a job or a loved one waiting somewhere in that world outside the prison. Frankl writes that sensitive people who were used to a rich intellectual life may have suffered much pain. They were often of a delicate physical constitution, but the damage to their inner selves was less. They were able to retreat from their terrible surroundings to a life of inner riches and spiritual freedom. So, in other words, the prisoners had no power to shape how they internally received the experience. They had the power to shape how they internally received the experience of the camp, even though they had no power to shape its external realities. In theological terms, nowadays we might call this religious naturalism. Now, I preached about this before because in many ways, those attracted to Unitarian Universalism are often drawn to this theological perspective called religious naturalism. So what is it? Well, religious naturalism views the realities of the world for what they are. Everyday products of nature. And by nature, I mean everything in the world, not just flowers and trees, but all of it. Everything here is nature in some form or another, grounded in scientific realities. The central story of a religious naturalist is the epic of evolution, explaining the origin of the cosmos and humanity. If God enters the picture for a religious naturalist, and oftentimes God doesn't, this God would not be one who actively causes events in the world. The religious orientation of this perspective acknowledges the importance of recognizing a spiritual response to life's realities, especially feelings of gratitude, humility, reverence, and joy at the wonder of being alive. Ursula Goodenough says, "Nature elicits both awe and humility. There's the gratitude and astonishment of being alive at all. There's reverence for nature's outrageous beauty and complexity. There's the joy of participation." So in other words, religious naturalism invites us to pay attention to the holy moments of our everyday realities. And in so doing, we cultivate hope right here in this world. This is an important skill to have. And we know that, again, this week from yet another school shooting, cultivating hope. I remember when I entered seminary, against the advice of my school advisor at that time, I decided to take preaching as one of my first classes. "But that's a Bill Schultz class," my advisor said. Now, Bill Schultz, in case you didn't know, was the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association back in the 1980s, and then he went on to be the president of Amnesty International. He's been one of our most high-profile Unitarian Universalist ministers, appearing in countless debates on Fox News and CNN. And it's fun to talk with him about his off-air conversations with Sean Hannity and so on. If you ever get a chance, I really recommend it, but I foolishly didn't know enough about him at the time to be intimidated. Besides, I was confident. I was a pretty good preacher already. So, hey, I'll take this as one of my first classes and mark this off. So on Monday, the first day of class, Bill Schultz walked in all his Bill Schultzness and said, "I'm assigning a 5-page paper for Friday. The question, where do you find hope? If you can't answer this in a concrete way, and if you can't fill 5 pages, and you can't write less than 6 on this topic, then you have no business preaching." There went my confidence, right? Where do I find hope? Where do I find hope? That question haunted me that week. It was Monday, and I needed to know by Friday. Did he expect me to say something like, God was the answer? I can't do that. Maybe I made a mistake. Maybe in seminary, you do have to believe in God or Buddha or something. Maybe I have no business doing this kind of work. And then I thought of Olga, finding hope in a good cup of black coffee. And I realized there was my answer. To carry on, to find hope, we must seek out something. However we individually choose to identify it, we must seek out something to hold on to. Frankl speaks of this when he tells the story of the end of a long day gathered with the other exhausted prisoners. As they sat there, hungry, tired, another prisoner rushed in and told them to come outside quickly. They did, and they found themselves standing before a wonderful sunset. As Roger Fritz says, although the prison cut off most of the world from prisoners, it did not cut them off from the sky. The whole sky was alive with clouds of ever-changing shapes and colors, from steel blue to blood red. The desolate gray mud huts provided a sharp contrast as the puddles on the muddy ground reflected the glowing sky. After minutes of moving silence, one prisoner said to another, "How beautiful the world could be." These prisoners, whether they called it this or not, and I'm sure they didn't, but they were looking through a religious naturalist lens in this moment. Here they were in the worst of circumstances, and yet they were actively finding hope in a sunset. The truth is that they could have chosen to walk by that sunset and not take it in, and they had every reason in the world not to do so. They were abused, tired, hungry, ill, wounded. But choosing to drink in that sunset was their choice. And that's the thing about hope. We get to make the choice to find it or not. When life is hard or challenging, and it is, we have every excuse not to look for it. But Frankl writes, the experiences of camp life show that man does have a choice of action. There were enough examples, often of a heroic nature, which proved that apathy could be overcome, irritability suppressed. Man can preserve a vestige of spiritual freedom, of independence of mind, even in such terrible conditions of psychic and physical stress. In other words, we always have that choice to look for hope or not. I'm reminded of this story. A man comes crying into the house after noticing that his wallet is missing. "What's the matter?" asks his wife. "My wallet is gone," he says. I'm pretty sure I put it in my inside coat pocket. I can't find it." "Did you look in your pants pocket?" she asked. Yes, the wallet isn't there either." "Well, it was in your jacket." "Well, how about the side pocket of your jacket? Did you look there?" "Of course not," he snaps. "Do you want me to lose the last bit of hope I have left?" Of course, what Frankl says is the opposite. We keep looking for hope, even in that inside pocket, because if we do, we can find it somewhere. Even if it's just in our minds, as we heard in our reading today, just in the memory of a loved one. Viktor Frankl's parents, brother, pregnant wife, all died in the camps. And still, he wrote this book saying that we can choose to find meaning and hope if we are intentional about it. We can choose to use our brains to conjure up memories and thoughts that keep us going. We can choose to see the natural beauty of the world around us. We can choose, even in the darkest of circumstances, to look for the light. This is complementary to the idea of religious naturalism, of finding the holy in the everyday realities of our lives. We can choose to take those moments in or not. I think back to Olga, the woman I was briefly neighbors with so long ago. Life had been hard for her, no doubt. And it was the acknowledgement of life's simple gifts that got her through it. A good cup of coffee, a good conversation, a daily walk to the market where there was always enough food. A religious naturalist perspective invites us to savor what we find in life, to feel the holiness of a given moment in its simplicity. We embrace the power of what our minds can see. We come back around to that first paper I had to write for Bill Schultz's seminary class, My Source of Hope. Here's a small part of what I said. And I'm reminded, you know, as I pull something out that I wrote years ago, this isn't written down anywhere, but if you go to New England, and you'll hear all kinds of stories about Emerson that have been passed down through the oral tradition. But Emerson would get up and read sermons to thousands of people, sermons that he'd written years before, and midway through he'd say, I no longer believe that. But I do believe this. So what I wrote then was, when I started to think about my source of hope, I wanted to say something that sounded lofty or grand, something of great theological import that would cut through the Gordian knot to the heart of the meaning of life. But the more I thought about times in my own life where I had felt adrift in a flood of fear and despondency, the more I've recognized that it's not necessarily events of great consequence that have gotten me through those difficult times. It was the little things, little moments of joy or awareness that connects us back with our humanity and reminds us of our resilience and why life is worth living. When we find ourselves awash in tragedy and loss, disillusionment and sadness, we have to look for these life rafts floating on the floodwater around us. Viktor Frankl writes, we who lived in concentration camps can remember the men who walked through the huts comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's way. And how do we choose our way in the midst of suffering, tragedy, loss, struggle, and pain? We all have experienced those things, though most of us have never been in, or hopefully never will be in, a prison camp. We have all been in prisons made for us from time to time by circumstances, human evils, or our own selves. We have felt trapped and at a loss for what to do. When life is hard, let us remember that it is our response to its challenges that really counts. More than the challenges themselves, that survival is not based on a foolish kind of optimism, but recognizing that even in the worst of circumstances, we have agency in where we allow our hearts and minds to go, that we are ultimately the makers of our own experiences, however challenging they may be. For all that is our life is ours to make of it what we will.